Well, I don't know where you're at as you're walking in here tonight. You feel like you're stuck in the grind. You know what I mean by that? It's just this kind of perpetual feeling that I'm doing the same thing over and over and over. It doesn't feel like it's really changing. It's, you know, same people, same faces, same stuff. The grind. Are you disappointed with the hand that you've been dealt? This could be congenital disease, things that you were born with, maybe the way that you were made. You feel like you're not comparing well to other people, that you're just going through inordinate suffering that other people aren't and do not understand. Yeah, that can really wear away at you if you've ever been through that. Will you finally be happy when fill in the blank happens, when you get that degree? Do you feel like you'll be happy when you get that boyfriend or girlfriend, when you finally, you know, get married, when you finally have kids, when you finally get that job, that inheritance, that blank, whatever blank is for you? Do you think that's the point at which you'll finally be content and happy? Well, Paul has much to say about this, because as we look at all of these things here, Paul was going through all of them. Day in, day out, it was the same people he was sitting next to, chained to a Roman guard in a house arrest under Roman custody. Talk about the grind, just sitting there day in, day out, you know, going to the toilet, chained to a Roman guard. Talk about a grind there, that would not be good. Being disappointed with the hand that you've been dealt. Paul, stuck in Roman jail. What would that be like? How would you be feeling? Wondering, you know, am I going to be happy when finally I get the sentence that goes in my favor and I'm out of this hell, which is Roman house arrest? We get a totally different perspective from Paul. Nothing like this. Very shocking. Just to read this as a secular document from the first century, you would be shocked to read what he's having to say in these circumstances and conditions. He says in verse 10, he says, "I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you have been renewed with regard to your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but you had no opportunity to show that concern." What he means here is that these Philippians were trying to give to Paul financially. As he makes clear in verses 14 to 20, he says, "You wanted to give me money, and yet you didn't have the opportunity, and yet now finally the opportunity, the door is being opened." And so he says, "You're trying to give me money, and that's wonderful, but I'm not saying this because I need the money." You know, if you're in Roman house arrest, chained to a Roman guard, stuck in, you know, I mean, we're talking about not a big room here, you know, maybe a small dorm room, and you're stuck there every day, and he's saying, "It's not that I need your money." Like, that'd be great if you want to give me money, but I don't need it. "For," he says, "I've learned to be content, whatever the circumstances." Content. This word, autarkes, this is the word that was used by Cynic and Stoic philosophers to literally refer to being self-reliant or to being self-sufficient. So if you know anything about Cynic or Stoic philosophy, you know that they were really detached, that they wanted to be removed from the world and in various different ways, that they wanted to show that they were able to stand up on their own without any kind of help from others. And Paul, kind of wagging his finger at Stoic philosophy, remember he used those philosophical terms in verse 8, whatever is lovely, whatever is true, whatever is pure, etc., etc. Now he's saying, "I've learned to be content." He takes their word, self-reliant, and he says, "I've learned to be content." And you might think that Paul means by this that he's learning to depend more and more on himself. Not so. From the outside looking in, it would look that way. You'd be looking at Paul like a Superman. How is he able to weather this series of circumstances with joy? How could he do that? Looking from the outside in, it would look like self-reliance or self-sufficiency. And yet, it's kind of like looking at, you know, the movies where you see Superman going off and flying, and yet you get the behind the scenes and you realize, no, this is just a bunch of green screens. You know what I'm saying? Like, I thought he was flying. He wasn't really flying. That was a bunch of Hollywood mumbo jumbo going on there. And really, when you get the look, I mean, these guys look pretty, what's the word? Stupid, when they're being held up by all these green screens and such. But when you see the finished product, it's mediocre, the movie. But, when you see the finished product, you see Superman fly. I mean, the special effects are good, at least. It'd be better if we had good acting and writing and plot and directing and so forth. But I mean, the special effects are fantabulous. Well, that's what we're seeing here, is behind the scenes, according to Paul, he's saying, yeah, I look this way on the outside, but on the inside, I'm being held up by cables and ropes and stuntmen helping me in front of a green screen. You can't see all that. That's all hidden inside the heart. But if only you knew the kind of power that I have access to through the person of Jesus Christ. But you can't see that. And so he says, I know what it is to be in need. I know what that is, to be needy. And I know what it is to have plenty. I know that. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. So he's speaking across the whole spectrum here, isn't he? Yeah. Hungry or full, plenty or scarcity, no, it doesn't matter. Any and every situation. That is what we call universal language. He's saying, no matter what hand I'm dealt, I have learned the secret of being content. What's the secret? I can do all things through him who gives me strength. So again, from the outside looking in, Paul looks very self-sufficient, very self-reliant. He says, no. From the inside looking out, I'm seeing that it's Christ propping me up. And there is something that I'm doing. As he says in Philippians 2:12, you need to work out your salvation. He says, but it is God who is working in me to will and to work according to his good pleasure. So it is something that I can do. I can do all things. I do that through him who gives me strength. Now, unfortunately, this verse has been so repeated over and over that it becomes, what's the expression? Familiarity breeds contempt. That you see this verse all the time. You know, we get it from Tim Tebow, you know, putting it on his markers underneath his football thing. We get it from Steph Curry, who's just a terrible person. And he gets it on his shoes. I'm bitter with the Cavs. Okay. He puts it on his shoes, 4:13, and his explanation is this. He says, it represents a Bible verse I wear on my shoe, Philippians 4:13. It says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. It's also my mantra, how I get up for games and why I play the way I do. Now, if he was just saying this is just some kind of a mantra, something that gets me in the zone, you know, like before I teach up here, I listen to Free Bird by Lynyrd Skynyrd. I really do. I get all hyped up, you know, this redneck classic rock, and then I get down here and I'm like, let us pray, you know. But if that's all he's saying, like this is just something that makes me feel good, okay, good for you. But he is a committed Christian, Steph Curry. And he's saying, I use this, what, as a mantra. Not that it actually means that. That's not what the intention of the author or the authorial intent was. It's just something that makes me feel good about going out to play. Oh, come on. To what does all things refer? Would it be valid to cite this verse and say, I can do all things through him who gives me strength to beat up an innocent person? Perhaps a little kid for his lunch money. I can do all things through him who gives me strength to beat the daylights out of you and get your lunch money. You say, oh, no, that's not in God's will. Oh, yes, you're with me. What about I can do all things to give me strength to bench press 2,000 pounds? And you're like, no, that's impossible. So if I claim that promise and get under the weight of basically a small car and try and bench press that and it crushes me, would I say that God's word has failed? You say, well, no, dude, you're not getting it. It's all things. All things doesn't mean all things. It's limited to God's will. That's my point. What about I can do all things through him who gives me strength, and that means that I'm going to be healed from this cancerous tumor that is metastasized and spread throughout my body? Now, you might say, well, what do you mean? Are you saying that we can't have the strength of God through times of incredible grief and pain and suffering? That's not my point. Could we claim this verse to say, I will be healed from cancer? How? Because God can do all things through him who gives me strength. What this would mean is that people who aren't healed from cancer just didn't have enough faith to believe Philippians 4:13. Am I bothering you yet? My point is to bother you and not to use this verse in an inappropriate way, because that's not the context. And every verse that's taken from its context becomes a pretext. And we are basically using it for our own agenda. And at that point, it ceases to be God's word. You might say, well, no, those are God's words. Yes, but if you're using it in an illegitimate fashion, it ceases to be his word because you're using it for an inappropriate means. You're not communicating what God is communicating. Follow me? So, that doesn't answer our question. To what does all things refer? Well, it refers to this. This is the criterion. Just like when Jesus says, you should pray for anything in my name, and it will be granted to you. The important part is that prepositional phrase, in my name, if it's in his name. Or to use the language of 1 John 5:14, if you pray anything according to his will, it will be given to you. You can know that you have it. Same thing is true here. I can do all things through him. What this means is, Paul is saying we can do anything that pertains to the will of God. If it's within God's will, this is incredible. We can bank on the promise of Philippians 4:13. If we know that it's God's will to go and to serve him and to love him and to love others, if we know it's God's will that he's going to build his Christian community, if we know it's God's will that he's going to continue to grow us and change us in spiritual growth, we can bank on Philippians 4:13 for this to happen. All things is all things within the purview of God's will. Well, let's think about this for a moment. Paul is basically explaining what it means to find contentment. Let's unpack this further. How do we find contentment? Is it something that comes to us through a certain personality type? No, it's not. And thank God for that. You meet these people that are just naturally buoyant and happy all the time. And scientists have studied this. There's a certain set range of happiness, not a set point, like you're just at a scale to 10, you're just a 3 or a 7. There's a range. You know, you range from a 3 to a 7, or, you know, a 4 to an 8, or 5 to a 9, you get the idea. There's a range for people, and certain people are just bubbly and buoyant, and they have a personality type that is just happy and content, more so than others. That's great. However, this isn't limited to that, and even people with a kind of happy disposition, this doesn't mean that they're going to be content in the way that Paul is describing it here. For instance, they wouldn't be able to withstand the kind of suffering that Paul was withstanding with the same kind of joy that he was able to have. Paul himself was kind of a type A personality and didn't have the right personality type to be happy while in prison. Yet he was 16 times, as we've said, either in the noun or the verbal form, he says, joy or rejoice. He's just having a great time sitting here in prison. What do the Proverbs say? Proverbs 27, verse 20, just as death and destruction are never satisfied. That's true. Destruction always happening, death always happening. So human desire is never satisfied. So there's something innate to human nature that we are never satisfied. It's no matter how many blessings we get, we could get one after another, after another, after another. These could be piled on until they're breaking our back, and we're still thirsting, yearning for more, feeling like we don't have enough. Just as death and destruction never satisfied, human desire is never satisfied. Proverbs 15:15, for the despondent, you know what that is, the sad, the mopey, the despondent, every day brings trouble. For the happy heart, however, life is a continual feast. Do you know what a feast is like? In the ancient world, when they did weddings, these would last for 7 to 10 days. How about that? You go to a wedding, and I mean, it would just go on for a week, week and a half. He's saying your life is like that. To someone who chooses a happy heart. Tranquility is the word here. It's not personality. This is something we choose. Circumstances. Is it circumstances? That can't be, because Paul says in verse 11, we read that ourselves, in whatever circumstances we find ourselves. It isn't the circumstances. No way. Indeed, when we study economics, when we study psychology, we see this confirmed. It doesn't matter what circumstances in which you find yourself. You're always going to be lusting for more. A study of 5,000 British people found this, quote, feelings of well-being for your income depend on a reference or comparison level of income. What's that saying? It means it doesn't matter how much I make. Now, of course, being in abject poverty, that would be a certain state where that would bring unhappiness. Yes. If you can't feed yourself, if you can't feed your family, that would be a bad state to be, for sure. However, once you reach a certain point, which is for a household, $75,000 per year, per household. That's wife, husband, kids, 75K. Above that, there is no correlation between how much you earn and how happy you are. Zero. They're saying here, once you get past this certain point, you don't care how much you make. You just want to make more than the person that works across the desk from you. You want to make more than the person in the other cubicle. It would tear you up inside to discover that I'm doing the same work, or even that they're doing more work, that I'm not making as much as them. And I will be dissatisfied until I make that much. The problem is, once you make that much, you need a new reference point. And this becomes kind of a sickness that we see. Now, not circumstances. See, this is what we're saying, to make this real simple. In our world today, the message, the indoctrination that we receive everywhere from the internet to TV to Netflix, Hulu commercials, radio, if you still listen to that, you know, everything is telling you, it's imbibing this idea that if you have good circumstances, that's going to lead to contentment. And if you have bad circumstances, that's going to lead to discontentment. This is just gospel truth in our culture today. According to the Bible, you could have the best circumstances in the world and still be discontent. And you could have the worst circumstances in the world and be perfectly content. And so this is what Paul is trying to pound through our skulls, because this isn't something that's new to us in the 21st century in the Western world. This is something that is part and parcel of the human condition. And we can't get away from it. Let's just pause and think about this. We keep thinking, if I can change my circumstances, I will feel good. And according to the Bible, circumstances and joy, these are not connected. Instead, we can have joy independent of our circumstances. What about comparison to others? Oh, this is a sickness. Proverbs 14:30, a heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. Boy, I would hate to see the doctor and he says you have a disease. What is it, doc? You have bone rotting disease. Oh, that sounds terrible. What's the cure? Well, it's to stop envying people all the time. That's the cure. Rotting my bones. That sounds disgusting. Well, social media, that does have some advantages. I use it. I like it, I guess. But what it does engender are what are called these upward social comparisons. Why is it that we see study after study after study that says the longer you're on social media, the more depressed you become? Why is that? Because you're comparing your personal negative circumstances and my bad day and the way I've been treated and all that. I'm comparing my worst with other people's highlight reel. You know what a highlight reel is? I got stuck on YouTube this week, and they were doing a highlight reel of Larry Bird, number 33 for the Boston Celtics, vis-a-vis circa 1980s or something. Anyways, I grew up on Larry Bird. I loved Larry Bird. So I'm watching Larry Bird, and I'm watching these highlight reels, and they were showing him, you know, do these passes and shooting. And I mean, it was cool and everything, but I'm like, they're making Larry Bird out to be the best basketball player of all time. And he just wasn't. I mean, he was good, but he was not that great. Well, the same thing is true when it comes to social media. We're constantly looking at other people's highlight reel. Oh, I love this daiquiri while I'm in Hawaii with my, you know, hot spouse and tons of money. And, you know, you're comparing my regular life and how I'm feeling right now to how they're doing, their highlight reel. That's not comparable. You could take all of, you know, LeBron James's worst flubs and screw-ups and compare it to Larry Bird's highlight reel, and it'd make you think that Larry Bird is something really special. Larry Bird is not something special. I guess that's my point. What about instantaneous? Is this something that we just, you know, is it a dimmer switch or is it a toggle switch? Is this something that we get instantaneously, or is it something that takes time, over time, this changes? Well, this is definitely the latter. It's more like a dimmer switch where it's slow. Paul says you had to learn this. So it's slowly, it's that, well, that light is being turned on in your life, and we can't have the expectation that this is going to happen overnight. It doesn't work that way. Not in the things you might think, working hard. It's discipline and gratitude. It's discipline and prayer, things that ways, means through which God can speak to us. Well, how do we find contentment? Let me give you four different ways from the passage that we learn contentment. Isn't this what we want? Wouldn't this be nice if you could just enjoy who you are? Wouldn't it be nice if you could just be happy with yourself first thing in the morning, that you just were free from the envy, the jealousy, the pain, the insecurity? Wouldn't that just be nice if you could just be free from that? Wow, that would be a secret to learn, wouldn't it? The first means to contentment is to give out to other people. Yes, Paul was real big on this. This was his whole lifestyle. He had adopted this lifestyle, giving out. I remember listening to NPR, and they said, you know, we've done some scientific studies and interviewed some psychologists, and they have discovered that it makes you more happy to give away rather than to take in. That is true. Yeah, Paul says here in verse 14, you've done well to share with me in my affliction. So giving out actually makes you more content. That's what he's approving of this in this church. Well, yeah, the psychological study backs this up. They call this pro-social giving. So it isn't giving to myself and what I can get. It's giving pro-socially to other people, to build other people up. So can we buy happiness? Yes, we can buy happiness. You're just not buying the right things. You think, I need that new phone. I need that new car. I need that. No. Those are things that are going to bring regret, buyer's remorse, and sickness and sadness. Buying things for others, buying things for those in need, as Paul says, for in my affliction, giving money to something like that, to the cause of Jesus Christ, that brings happiness. Yes, it does. Now, when we do this voluntarily, you know, if your boss said to you, we're going to give a certain percentage of your money to, you know, whatever organization, and that's, you know, going to be some charitable giving, it'd make you feel happy because at the end of the year, you know, you gave whatever to the, you know, whatever or whoever. But if you volitionally choose to give money voluntarily, the happiness just soars. Even if you're giving the same amount, even if they're taking the same amount out of your paycheck, but you're making the choice, I am giving this, I'm willingly giving this, your happiness increases. So much for the idea. You hear from some people who say, well, you know, I give to the poor with my taxes every year. Wrong. We're talking about something that's exceeding what everyone else is doing. Jesus said that's the bare minimum. Everyone should be giving their taxes. Give me a break. Are you serious? We're talking about actually giving to a point where it hurts. Giving out voluntarily. Not that if you don't give, you get thrown in jail. That's not what we're talking. That's not very altruistic, sacrificial. University of Oregon, there was a study of some economists who did a study where they gave $100 to these people, and they said, you can spend it on yourself or you can spend it on the local food bank. The majority of the people who gave to the food bank. I mean, just a food bank. They didn't really know what was going on there, but it's a food bank. It's a good, you know, service for the community. The people who gave a $100 bill of Benjamin Franklin to the food bank, way happier than the people who spent it on themselves. Why would that be? Merely remembering how we once gave money to other people and our finance, it makes us happier. Just thinking about that time where I gave money away, where I built somebody else up, that increases happiness. Oh, this study. Hold on to your butts here. This is incredible here. In the words of Samuel Jackson, Jurassic Park, 1994. Hold on to your butts. 1 million people. 1 million people across 130, how many countries are there? 270 something? I don't know. This is two-fifths, a third, half the countries on planet Earth. So multicultural, million people, they found, they quote, one of the top six predictors of life satisfaction around the world was what? Pro-social spending. Oh, this is so weird. So like no matter what culture in which you find yourself, this always works. This always brings happiness. It's almost like this is the way we were designed by God. That we weren't meant to be these vacuums and black holes of resources, but like him, we were designed to give out. Same findings are there in South Africa compared to Canada in one study. Canadians, rich. South Africans, in this study, 1 out of 5 didn't know where their next meal was going to come from. They did the same study with them. Even with those folks who were in poverty or even in abject poverty, when they gave the money away, happier. Happier. It's no wonder in Luke 21, Jesus sees the poor widow drop the 2 coins into the dish, and he says she gave more than them all. Jesus didn't say, well, she's so poor and she's so old, she should have kept that for herself. He says, no, that was the best thing she could have ever done. Being a giver. And to be sure, this is a lifestyle of love. This isn't something that we just dabble in. Yeah, if you get the $100 in the Oregon study and you give it to the food bank, it'll make you a little bit happier. That's not what we're talking about. Paul isn't discussing. Paul had dived in, you know, full body cannonball into the water on this lifestyle of servant love. This isn't something we dabble in. It's something that we choose to get into. Now, of course, this is something that we grow in. I never like when Bible teachers make it seem like, okay, yeah, you're going to get into this, and then tomorrow you're going to be the most sacrificial person on earth. Okay, this takes time, as we're saying. This is a process. However, this is not just something that we dabble in. This is something that we jump in. As I said, I remember listening to NPR, and they said, you know, I guess that old adage is true. It is more blessed to give than to receive. I thought, that's not an old adage. That's JC. He's the one who taught that. Acts 20:35. Paul says to the Philippians, you gave me money more than once in verse 16. Yeah, this was ongoing. It wasn't just giving spontaneously. It was, I want to keep meeting your needs. So too, and this might seem counterintuitive, receiving from other people. This is hard. To give out and give out and give out. We feel like, okay, I can do that. But as soon as someone wants to serve me, I say no. Why is that? Why could that be? Am I just such a godly man? I'm such a spiritual man. I'm just so much like Jesus. I could never be served. Or is it pride? Is it pride that I'm comfortable giving out to other people because that makes me feel better about myself and I have some kind of a stature in my own heart and thinking that, yeah, I give out to them. But to humble myself and let other people meet my own needs, no, I don't want to do that. Paul had no problem here. Paul's attitude here was, if you want to give to me, the answer is not, oh, it's okay. No big deal, or it's all right. His answer was, thank you. And we need to drill this into our heads as well when people are trying to serve us. And we need to cut it out with the, no, it's all right. It's all right. I'm perfect. You don't need to help me. We need to get into this, the 2 words, thank you. That would be great. I would love that. Paul rejoiced in the Lord. Yeah. Well, finally, confidence in and from Christ through him. That's really the key here, isn't it? We're getting a lot of tangential ways to build contentment. But here we're seeing, right from the text, I can do all things through him who gives me strength. He tells these Philippians, he says, you're giving me all this money. And according to 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 2 through 5, the Corinthians were in dire straits financially. They weren't giving out of an abundance. They were giving out of poverty. And Paul accepts the gift. And he says in verse 19 of this chapter, he says, my God will meet all of your needs according to his glorious riches in Christ Jesus. This was the secret. To realize that I'm going to give out and give out and give out. Well, who's going to give to me? And Paul says, Jesus Christ will. As soon as that reservoir is tapped, he's going to fill it right back up. Well, yeah, but what kind of resources does he have? According to his glorious riches, he's got plenty. You never need to worry about this. He's going to give and give and give. Never worry about outgiving God. Never worry about that. He will take care of your needs. Not your greed, but your need. And so, that brings us to the end of the letter to the Philippians. What was Paul's secret here? Well, he was an interesting character. He really believed. Like, he actually believed. He was one of these strange people that really believed that Jesus would always love him, he would never leave him, and he would continue to empower him, no matter what. What if you really, I mean really, actually, believe that? That Jesus Christ is always, he's always happy with me. All those guilt feelings, all that feeling of inadequacy. I'm not the person I used to be. I'm trying hard. What if all that was just completely encompassed by his love? What if you just felt at all times that whenever you went out to give to others, that he was right there with you, that he says, I will never forsake you, never abandon you? What if you just always sensed or believed that his power was there applicable to you? This would change your life. I wasn't sure if I was going to share this, but I better. Over the last few weeks, maybe 3 weeks ago, I fell into somewhat of a depression. For me, I don't really know what's going on in here. I don't know if you're like that. But I was seeing the symptoms, like couldn't fall asleep at night, couldn't wake up in the morning, irritable as anything, short-fused, foggy, I couldn't think, nothing in my life was bringing me any joy. This is how it feels when you're in a state of depression. It's just kind of a haze. And it was through studying this book with you guys, remembering these truths, opening up to other people, loved ones, friends, opening up to my wife, that it's like the dam burst and this was released, and I can tell you, look you straight in the eye and tell you the depression is lifted. I feel great. I don't feel like I'm at the stage of the Apostle Paul, in case that wasn't completely obvious. But I do feel and know that I'm getting better. This recent bout for me, I got there quicker. I diagnosed it faster. Was able to ask for help. Man, God, 10 years ago, this would have been a year ordeal. This would have been 6 months. And all of a sudden, you start to discover you're getting there quicker, and God's revealing it faster, and you're responding faster. And that's a real encouraging key to success. I think if people are shortening the gap where they're getting there quicker, that's a good sign. I hope you can get that. I hope you can learn the great secret of this book. Yeah, we'll leave it there.